Miramax Films. SB Shorescope. Our feature presentation. Revenge is a dish best served cold. Old Klingon proverb. Miramax Films presents A Band Apart in black and white. A bloodied and bruised blonde-haired woman wearing a wedding dress and veil is lying on the floor. A man in jeans and cowboy boots struts towards her.
Do you find me sadistic?
He wipes a handkerchief with the name Bill embroidered on it against her cheek.
You know, I'll bet I could fry an egg on your head right now if I wanted to. No, kiddo. I'd like to believe you're aware enough, even now, to know that there's nothing sadistic in my actions. Or maybe towards those other jokers. But not you. No, kiddo. At this moment, this is me and my most masochistic.
Bill, it's your baby.
The fourth film by Quentin Tarantino. Uma Thurman. Kill Bill, Volume 1.
I was 5 and he was 6. We rode on horses made of sticks.
Co-starring Judy Dreyfuss, Michael Bowen, Jun Kunimura, Kenji Oba, Yuki Kazamatsuri, James Parks.
I hit the ground. Bang, bang, that awful sound.
Akaji Maro, Kazuki Kitamura, Goro Daimon, Shun Sugata, and the 5678s. As the deadly Viper assassination squad. 1. Lucy Liu as Oren Ishii. 2. Vivica A. Fox as Vanita Green. 3. Michael Madsen as Bud. 4. Daryl Hannah as L. Driver. 5. David Carradine as Bill. Guest starring Sonny Chiba.
Bang, bang.
Chiaki Kuriyama as Gogo. Gordon Liu. Michael Parks.
Music played and people sang. Just for me, the church bells rang.
The bride's motionless, horizontal body is lit in silhouette.
Now he's gone, I don't know why. Until this day, sometimes I cry. He didn't even say goodbye. He didn't take the time to lie. Bang, bang, he shot me down. Bang, bang, I hit the ground. Bang, bang, that awful sound. Bang, bang, my baby shot me down.
Chapter 1. 2. The city of Pasadena, California. In a colourful, typical suburban neighbourhood, a garish orange and yellow pickup pulls up outside one of the identikit houses. The bride, now with no visible sign of injury, is wearing a brown leather jacket. She gets out of the pickup and strides across the lawn, which is littered with children's playthings. Having pressed the doorbell, she waits patiently.
Coming! Sarah, I cannot believe you are early.
The bride stares with a piercing gaze at the young woman who has just answered the door. She thinks back to her wedding and the same woman standing over her battered body. Then, snapping out of her memory, she punches the woman in the face. When the bride tries to hit her again, she blocks her attack and tosses her against a wall, smashing a mirror. The woman tries to kick her while she's down, but the bride throws her legs up and connects with her jaw, sending her flying into a glass table. The woman uses one of the broken table legs as a club, but the bride soon grabs her and locks an arm around her neck in a tight chokehold. The woman struggles and they both tumble to the floor. She reaches up and manages to grab a fire poker, which she hits the bride over the head with before being kicked backwards. The housewife pushes a stack of shelves down onto the bride, showering her with broken glass and china. They move the fight to the kitchen, where the bride uses a frying pan to deftly defend herself from a carving knife. The bride takes her own knife from a scabbard on the waistband of her jeans, and they square off.
Come on, bitch. Come on. Bring it on.
They stare at one another, moving nimbly back and forth across the living room to avoid each other's strikes and slashes. The housewife backs up past a set of double windows, crunching the broken glass of the coffee table underfoot. Through the window, they both see a yellow school bus pulling up outside. The woman looks at the child getting off, then turns to the bride, shaking her head and wearing a terrified expression. As the young girl comes in through the front door, both fighters suddenly hide their weapons.
Mommy, I'm home.
Hey, baby. How was school?
Mommy, can I talk to you in the TV room?
Oh. That good-for-nothing dog of yours got his little ass in the living room and acted a damn fool. That's what happened, baby.
Barney did this?
Baby, now you can't come in here. There's broken glass everywhere and you could cut yourself.
The girl notices the blood and sweat on both their faces and stares at the bride.
This is an old friend of Mommy's I ain't seen in a long time.
Hi, honey. I'm Mr. Seuss. What's your name?
Her name is Nikki.
Nikki. Such a pretty name for such a pretty girl. How old are you, Nikki?
Mickey? Did you suggest your question?
I'm 4.
4 years old, eh? You know, I had a little girl once. She'd be about 4 now.
Now, baby, me and Mommy's friend got some grown-up talk to talk about. So you can go in your room now, and I want you to leave us alone till I tell you to come out. Okay? Nakia! In your room now.
Nikki walks off, still staring at the bride. As soon as she's gone, the bride pulls the knife out from behind her back.
You want some coffee?
Yeah, sure.
The two women walk casually into the kitchen.
This Pasadena homemaker's name is Jeannie Bell. Her husband is Dr. Lawrence Bell. But back when we were acquainted 4 years ago, her name was Fernita Green. Her code name was Copperhead. Mine, Black Mamba.
Do you have a towel?
Yeah. You still take cream and sugar, right?
Yeah.
So I suppose it's a little late for an apology, huh?
You suppose correctly.
Look, bitch. I need to know if you're gonna start any more shit around my baby girl.
You can relax for now.
I'm not going to murder you in front of your child, okay?
That's being more rational than Bill led me to believe you were capable of.
It's mercy, compassion, and forgiveness I lack, not rationality.
Look, I know I fucked you over. I fucked you over bad. I wish to God I hadn't, but I did. You have every right to want to get even.
No. To get even? Even, Stephen? I would have to kill you. Go up to Nikki's room, kill her. Then wait for your husband, the good Dr. Bell, to come home and kill him. That would be even, Vernita. That'd be about square.
Look, if I could go back in a machine, I would. But I can't. All I can tell you is that I'm a different person now.
Oh, great. I don't care.
Be that as it may, I know I don't deserve your mercy or your forgiveness. However, I beseech you for both on behalf of my daughter.
Bitch, you can stop right there. Just because I have no wish to murder you before the eyes of your daughter does not mean that parading her around in front of me is going to inspire sympathy. You and I have unfinished business, and not a goddamn fucking thing you've done in the subsequent 4 years, including getting knocked up, is going to change that.
So when do we do this?
It all depends. When do you want to die? Tomorrow? The day after tomorrow?
How about tonight, bitch?
Splendid. Where?
There's a baseball diamond where I coach our little league about a mile from here. We meet there around 2:30 in the morning, dressed all in black. Your hair in a black stocking. And we have us a knife fight. We won't be bothered. I have to fix Nikki's cereal.
Benita takes a box of cereal from the cupboard and a spoon from a drawer.
Bill always said you were one of the best ladies he ever saw with an edged weapon.
Fuck you, bitch. I know he didn't qualify that shit. So you can just kiss my motherfucking ass, Black Mamba. Black Mamba. I should have been motherfucking Black Mamba.
Weapon of choice, and if you want to stick with your butcher knife, that's fine with me.
Very funny, bitch. Very funny!
Benita fires a bullet through the cereal box that just misses the bride. In response, she grabs her knife from its holster and hurls it straight into Benita's chest. The bride slowly steps towards Benita as she crumbles in a heap on the floor and dies. Then, the bride kneels down at her side and pulls the blade from her chest. After a long moment, she gets to her feet, turns to go and sees Nikki standing in the doorway. The young girl stares up at her with wide, innocent eyes. The bride meets her gaze for a moment, before turning away and wiping the blood from the knife with a tea towel.
It's not my intention to do this in front of you. For that, I'm sorry. But you can take my word for it. Your mother had it coming.
She slides the knife back into its leather scabbard. For those regarded as warriors, when engaged in combat, the vanquishing of thine enemy can be the warrior's only concern. Suppress all human emotion and compassion. Kill whoever stands in thy way, even if that be Lord God or Buddha himself. Back in the colorful pickup, the bride is looking at a piece of paper headed Deathless Five. The top name, Oren Ishii, has been crossed out already. She strikes through the second name, Benita Green. The voiceover continues, "This truth lies at the heart of the art of combat." The bride drives off in the pickup, which has the words "Pussy Wagon" emblazoned on the back in bright pink letters. Chapter 2, The Blood-Splattered Bride. Four years and 6 months earlier, in the city of El Paso, Texas, the bride, in her wedding dress, lies motionless on the wooden floor of a church. Around her are several bloody corpses, one of which a coroner is crouched over. A man in sunglasses and a 10-gallon hat is driving along an empty desert road. Lined across the dashboard is a row of sunglasses, each with the same frame as the ones he's wearing, but slightly different coloured lenses. The car pulls up at the church, which has a police car and an ambulance outside it, but there's no sign of urgency.
Well, give me the gore details, son number one.
It's a goddamn massacre, Pop. They wiped out the whole wedding party execution style.
Give me a figure.
9 dead bodies. And we're talking the whole shebang. Bride, groom, reverend, reverend's wife. Hell, they even shot that old color fellow that plays the organ.
It appeared to me somebody objected to this union and wasn't able to hold their peace. Good gravy, Marie.
The floor's littered with bullet casings.
What'd I tell you, Pop? It's like a goddamn Nicaraguan death squad. Get a shit can in the bathroom, boy. You in the house of worship.
Sorry, Pop.
Well, it's definitely working professionals. I'd guesstimate Mexican Mafia hit squad. 4, maybe 5 strong.
How can you tell?
Well, a sure and steady hand did this. Ain't no squirrely amateur. It's the work of a solid dog. You can tell by the cleanliness and carnage. Now, to kill crazy rampage, though it may be, all the colors are kept inside the line. If you was a moron, you could almost admire it.
The sheriff crouches down and takes off his green-tinted sunglasses to look at the bride.
Who's the bride?
Don't know. The name on the marriage certificate is Arlene Machiavelli. That's a fake. We've all just been calling her the bride on account of the dress.
He didn't tell her she was pregnant. Man, it'd be a mad dog. See that goddamn good-looking guy like that in the head? Look at her. Hay-colored hair. Big eyes. She's a little blood-spattered angel.
She coughs blood in his face.
Son number one?
Yeah.
This tall drinker, cocksucker ain't dead.
Sometime later, the bride is in a hospital bed. Her wounds have healed. As rain pours down the window outside, she lies unconscious in the dimly lit room. A woman with long blonde hair, wearing a stylish white suit, struts along the hospital corridor, a red umbrella in her hand. She has a white patch over her right eye and is whistling. She turns and opens the door to the ladies' toilets. As a nurse goes about her business, the bride remains motionless in her room, a few meters further along the corridor from the toilet. The woman with the eye patch takes off her white gloves, then pulls some white stockings up her legs. She does up the buttons on a similarly pristine coat and then slips on some simple, flat-soled shoes. She takes a syringe and fills it from a vial. She squirts a little of the red liquid out of the end and puts it down on a white towel before carefully securing a nurse's hat on her head. Now, with a new eye patch featuring a red cross, she walks out of the toilets holding a tray that carries the needle. She strolls casually along the corridor towards the bride's room. She stands at the door for a moment, looking at her through the window. L. Driver, member, Deadly Viper Assassination Squad. Codename, California Mountain Snake. L goes in and stands at the bride's bedside. She places her finger just over the bride's mouth, then cocks her head slightly to look at her face.
I might never have liked you. Quite in fact, I despise you. But that shouldn't suggest that I don't respect you. Dying in our sleep is a luxury that our kind is rarely afforded. My gift to you.
Elle slips the syringe into the bride's intravenous line, but then quickly pulls it out when her phone rings.
Hello, Bill.
What's her condition?
Comatose.
Where is she?
I'm standing over her right now.
That's my girl. Elle, you're going to abort the mission. We owe her better than that.
Oh, you don't owe her shit!
Will you keep your voice down?
You don't owe her shit!
May I say one thing?
Speak.
Y'all beat the hell out of that woman, but you didn't kill her. And I put a bullet in her head, but her heart just kept on beating. Now, you saw that yourself with your own beautiful blue eye, did you not? We've done a lot of things to this lady. And if she ever wakes up, we'll do a whole lot more. But one thing we won't do is sneak into her room in the night like a filthy rat and kill her in her sleep. And the reason we won't do that thing is because that thing would lower us. Don't you agree, Miss Driver?
I guess.
Do you really have to guess?
No, I don't really have to guess. I know.
Come on home, honey.
Affirmative.
I love you very much.
I love you too. Bye-bye.
With an air of frustration, Elle hangs up the phone and puts it away before moving back to the bride's bedside.
Thought that was pretty fucking funny, didn't you? Word of advice, shithead. Don't you ever wake up.
4 years later. The lights come on in a hospital ward. The room is filled with comatose patients, one of whom is the bride. A mosquito lands on her skin and begins to drink some of her blood. Suddenly, she sits bolt upright in bed.
This moment, this is me in my most masochistic.
Bill, it's your mission.
Flashing back to the church, the bullet from Bill's gun blasts down the chamber. Back in the moment, the bride pokes her head in the place where she was shot, and then taps it. She clutches her flat belly, gasping and crying as she feels around. She lifts up her hands and stares intensely at her palms, studying the lines and creases across them.
4 years. 4 years.
Hearing the whistling coming from outside, she stares at the door as the footsteps approach. As quickly as she sat up, she lays flat on her back as an orderly and a man in a trucker hat walk in. They stand at the foot of her bed and look down at her.
Price is $75 a fuck, my friend. You getting your freak on or what?
Oh, yeah, boy.
Now, here's the rules. Rule number one. No punching her. Nurse comes in tomorrow and she got her a shiner or less some teeth, jigs up. So no knuckle sandwiches under no circumstances. And by the way, this little cunt's a spitter. It's a motor reflex thing. But spitter, no, no punching. Now we absolutely positively clear on rule number one?
Yeah.
Good. Now rule number two, no monkey bites, no hickeys. In fact, no leaving no marks of no kind. After that, it's all good, buddy. Now, her plumbing down there don't work no more, so feel free to come in here all you want. Keep the noise down, try not to make a mess. I'll be back in 20. Oh, shit. Hey, by the way, not all the time, but sometimes this chick's cooch can get drier in a bucket of sand. If she dry, just lube up with this and you'll be good to go. Bon appetit, good buddy.
The nurse goes, and the trucker takes off his cap. He steps up onto the bed and straddles the bride.
Oh, goddamn, you are the best looking girl I've had today.
As he's leant over to kiss her, she's bitten hard into his lip. Moments later, her front's covered with his blood. She yanks the IV from her arm. She heaves herself out of bed, but crumples in a heap on the floor. As she tries to pull her legs into action, the orderly comes wandering back down the corridor. The bride throws some water over her face and washes off the trucker's blood. As the orderly wanders towards her room with a swagger, the bride grabs a flick knife from a holster on the trucker, then hauls herself across the room using her arms. He sees the trucker laid out on the floor and the bride's bed empty. The bride is laying back against the wall behind the orderly, the blade readied in her hand. She slashes it forward straight into his Achilles. She heaves him into position so that his head's against the doorframe, then grabs the door.
Where's Bill? Where's Bill?
Please stop hitting me.
Where's Bill?
I don't know who Bill is.
Bullshit!
She sees the name Buck on the orderly's name badge, and then the word fuck tattooed across his knuckles, and memories stir in her.
Well, ain't you the slice of cutie pie they said you were? Jane Doe, huh? Oh, we don't know shit about you.
Well, I'm from Huntsville, Texas. My name is Buck, and I'm here to fuck.
Your name is Buck, right? And you came here to fuck, right?
Wait a minute. Wait.
She smashes his head between the door and its frame. His body convulses, and she steals the gold-rimmed Elvis-style sunglasses from his top pocket. She rummages around in his trouser pockets and pulls out a set of keys. The fob is made up of the words Pussy Wagon in bright pink letters.
Pussy Wagon. Fucker.
She smashes his head once more in the door. She starts to undo his blue scrubs, and later is wearing them as she pushes herself through an underground car park in a wheelchair. Rolling steadily along a wide aisle, she stares at the rows of cars on either side. She screeches to a halt when she spots a bright yellow pickup with the same Pussy Wagon logo emblazoned on the back. She opens the rear door, revealing the garish yellow and red leather interior. Heaving herself up with her arms, she grabs onto the headrest of the front seat, then drops herself across the back. Using the handles above the door, she hauls herself fully into the wagon. Beads of sweat dripping down her face, she eventually sits herself up against the far door with her legs stretched out across the seats. Exhausted, she leans forward and pulls the door closed, then pulls back with a bump against the other. She stares down at her feet and begins massaging her thighs. With a look of utter concentration, she stares piercingly at her feet, willing them to move.
Wiggle your big toe.
It doesn't move.
Wiggle your big toe.
She clasps her hands, lacing the fingers together.
Wiggle your big toe. Wiggle your big toe. Wiggle your big toe.
As I lay in the back of Buck's truck, trying to will my limbs out of entropy.
Wiggle your big toe.
I could see the faces of the cunts who did this to me, and the dicks responsible. Members all of the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad. When fortune smiles on something as violent and ugly as revenge, it seems proof like no other that not only does God exist, you're doing his will. At a time when I knew the least about my enemies, the first name on my death list, Oren Ishii, was the easiest to find. But of course, when one manages the difficult task of becoming queen of the Tokyo underworld, one doesn't keep it a secret, does one?
Oren Ishii, member Deadly Viper Assassination Squad, codename Cottonmouth. Chapter 3, The Origin of Oren.
Oren Ishii was born on an American military base in Tokyo, Japan. The half-Japanese, half-Chinese American Army brat made her first acquaintance with death at the age of 9. It was at that age she witnessed the death of her parents at the hands of Japan's most ruthless Yakuza boss, Boss Matsumoto.
The young Oren, animated in an anime style, hides under a bed. She peers over at the boss, who's sitting in a chair breathing the smoke from a cigar out of his nose. A swordsman is holding his blade to her mother's neck. Her uniformed father strikes a fighting pose and tries to fight off a knife man. They exchange blows and the knife man is caught in an arm lock. Oren's father breaks the man's arm and then tosses him across the room. Another knife man lunges forward, swiping his blade at the soldier. Oren's father clamps his hand over the man's face and gouges his eyes before punching him into a wall. He finishes him off with a crunching punch to the face. Then suddenly Oren's father freezes and looks down to see a blade piercing his chest. An assassin removes the blade, and blood gushes out from the father's back as he falls to the floor. Landing just next to the bed, he looks at his daughter as blood showers down on his face. A second strike takes the life from him, and his eyes roll back in his head. Oren whimpers, but then clasps a hand over her mouth, trying to stop the noise escaping. The bloodied sword impaled in her father's head glints with a shimmering light. The assassin, with a distinctive skull ring on one finger, sweeps back his long hair. He seems to smile at Oren, who glares up at him, her eyes filled with hatred. The assassin wipes the blood from the blade as Boss Matsumoto cackles wildly, stubbing out his cigar. He grabs Oren's defenseless mother by the hair and pulls her over to the bed. She cowers as the assassin offers his blade to Matsumoto. The boss pulls it out of its sheath and lifts it high above his head. He drives it down through the bed and it misses Oren's head by only a matter of inches. Blood soaks the mattress above her. As the mattress becomes sodden, the blood drips down onto Oren's face. Matsumoto walks slowly from the room, followed by the two remaining swordsmen. One of them, the assassin, stops at the door and casts an eye over the aftermath of the bloodshed. Spotting a bottle of whiskey on a desk, he blasts it with a gun. Brushing his long hair out of one eye, he notices the remains of Matsumoto's cigar on the arm of a chair and kicks it across the room, where it ignites the booze on the desk. He watches for a moment as the room's engulfed by flames, then goes. Oren lies unmoving beneath the bed. Then presently, the whole house is ablaze, and Oren's standing some distance away, watching it.
She swore revenge. Luckily for her, Boss Matsumoto was a pedophile. At 11, she got her revenge.
She stabbed Matsumoto.
Matsumoto.
And says quite calmly, "Look at me, Matsumoto. Take a good look at my face. Look at my eyes. Look at my mouth. Do I look familiar? Do I look like somebody you murdered?" Oren pulls the blade from Matsumoto's belly and a fountain of blood spurts all over the room. She lowers the blade. The expression of hatred on her bloody face is replaced by a dead calm. Two of Matsumoto's bodyguards burst into the room and stare in shock. Seeing a mound in the patterned bedsheets, they immediately empty their guns into it. The gun smoke gradually disperses, revealing Matsumoto's dead body. There are bullet holes all over the mounds of sheets on top, while from her hiding place beneath the bed, Oren aims her pistol. Her first two shots take off one man's leg at the knee, and then his head. Her next cripples the second, sending him to the floor, where she decapitates him with a final bullet to the face.
By 20, she was one of the top female assassins in the world.
The older Oren stands on top of a building, wearing a slinky red catsuit and packing a high-powered rifle with sniper scope. On a road in the distance, she sees a motorcade of official black cars approaching. Inside one of them, a mustachioed man in a white presidential uniform cavorts with two young beauty queens. Oren takes careful aim and fires a shot that travels right through the car's windscreen, then through the man's forehead, splattering blood all over the back seat. The two beauty queens freak out.
At 25, she did her part in the killing of 9 innocent people, including my unborn daughter, in a small wedding chapel in El Paso, Texas. But on that day, 4 years ago, she made one big mistake. She should have killed 10. However, before satisfaction would be mine, first things first.
Wiggle your big toe.
The bride's big toe gives a few tiny twitches.
Hard part's over. Now, let's get these other piggies wiggling.
13 hours later, the door of the pickup opens, and the bride steps out onto the concrete floor of the car park. With short, halting steps, she walks to the driver's door and climbs in. The wagon's brake lights come on, and it reverses out of its parking space, then tears away at speed. Now, at an airline desk.
Welcome to Aero. May I help you?
Okinawa. One way.
An airplane icon zips across a world map, arriving at a Japanese island. Chapter 4. The Man from Okinawa. The island of Okinawa, Japan. The bride enters a sushi bar.
Hi.
The owner says, "Welcome." The bride smiles at the burly man.
"Welcome. You English?"
"Almost. American."
"American. Welcome, welcome.
Domo."
"My English very good.
You said domo. Can you speak Japanese?"
No. Just a few words I learned since yesterday. May I sit at the bar?"
Oh, sure, please, sit. Oh. What other words did you learn?"
The chef barks out back. "We have a customer. Bring out some tea, quickly." A voice replies, "I'm watching my soap operas." "Lazy bastard. Screw your soap opera. Hurry up. The tea's hot. Why don't you serve it yourself for once?"
"Shut up! Get your ass out of here!" "Excuse me. What other Japanese do you know?"
"Oh, let's see. Arigato."
"Arigato. Good."
I already said domo, right?"
Yeah.
Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa. Konnichiwa. Please repeat.
Konnichiwa.
Perfect. Good, good, good. You say Japanese word like you're Japanese.
Oh, now you're making fun of me.
No, 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 no. Serious business. Pronunciation very good. You say arigato? Like we say arigato.
Well, thank you. I mean, arigato.
Mm-hmm. You should learn Japanese. Very easy.
No kidding. I heard it was kind of hard.
Most of the world. But you have a Japanese tank. Okay, okay.
He presents her with some sushi.
Oh my God.
And then turns around to yell, "Hey, what the hell happened to the tea? Hurry up, goddammit." Lazy oaf. The kitchen assistant comes out and goes over to the bride. What do you want?
I beg your pardon?
Drink.
Oh, yes, a bottle of warm sake, please.
Warm sake? Very good!
One warm sake. Sake? In the middle of the day? Day, night, afternoon, who gives a damn? Get the sake! The assistant pipes up, yelling, "How come I always have to get the sake? You listen well. For 30 years, you make the fish, I get the sake. This were the military, I'd be general by now." The chef replies, "Oh, so you'd be general, huh? If you were general, I'd be emperor, and you'd still get the sake. So shut up and get the sake."
Do you understand?
I'm not bald, I shaved my head.
Do you understand me?
To the bride, the chef throws something at him.
Sorry. Nandakke? Oh, first time in Japan?
Uh-huh.
Oh. What brings you to Okinawa?
I came to see a man.
Oh, yeah. You have a friend living in Okinawa?
Not quite.
Not friend?
I never met him.
Never? Who is he? May I ask?
Hattori Hanzo.
The chef fixes the bride with an intent gaze, and suddenly all pretense is dropped from their faces. He asks, "What do you want with Hattori Hanzo?" She replies, "I need Japanese steel." "Why do you need Japanese steel?" She responds, "I have vermin to kill."
"You must have big rats. You need Hattori Hanzo's steel."
Huge.
A spacious room with clay walls and barred windows. Sunlight dapples the floor, and there are clothes hanging on a line. A trap door opens in the floor, and the bride emerges into the loft room. The chef, Hattori Hanzo, appears through the trap door and waits there, leaning his arm on the floor. The bride walks slowly across the room, as though in a trance, transfixed by something on the wall. There are four racks on the wall, each holding numerous samurai swords. The bride stares in awe at the beautifully sculptured weapons. Hattori watches her with a look of pride as she admires his master craftsmanship. The bride runs her eyes over the silken curves of the sword sheaths. A gently curved, ochre-coloured sheath rests on a rack above a darker one. The bride moves on to another rack, where there are two jet-black sheaths, the handle of one embroidered with red ribbon. She reaches out to touch the sheath, then snaps her hand back self-consciously and turns to Hattori for permission.
"May I?"
"You may."
She reaches for the sword.
"Wait. Try the second one down."
She does as he advises and gently places her palms beneath the black sword with the red embroidered handle. She lifts it off the rack and brings it slowly towards her. She feels its weight. Hattori steps into the room, watching her with fatherly pride. The bride smiles. She turns the sword around, gripping its handle, then slowly unsheathes it. The sword blade gleams. Her eyes are reflected in its cold steel. She fully unsheathes it.
Vani, you're like a samurai sword. I like baseball.
He hurls a baseball at her, and she slices it in half. Nodding, he says, I wanted to show you these. However, someone as you, who knows so much, must surely know I no longer make instruments of death. What I have here, I keep for their aesthetic and sentimental value. Yet, proud as I am of my life's work, he takes the sword from her. I have retired. Having sheathed the sword, he puts it back on the rack.
Then give me one of these.
These are not for sale.
I didn't say sell me. I said give me.
Why should I help you?
Because my vermin is a former student of yours. And considering the student, I'd say you have a rather large obligation.
Hattori looks troubled. He trudges across the room. He stops in front of an old framed photo of a swordsman on a shelf below a grimy window. He raises his forefinger up to the window, then hesitates. In the grime, he writes, Bill. He finishes by dotting the I with a Japanese-style slash and then hangs his head. He walks back over to the trap door and takes one step down. Resignedly, he says, You can sleep here. It will take me a month to make the sword. I suggest you spend it practicing. He then quickly disappears down the trapdoor. The bride approaches the window and wipes out Bill's name with her sleeve. She notices a fragment of the bee still partially visible and rubs it out with her finger. One month later, sitting cross-legged in a flowing white robe, Hattori holds the sheathed sword before him. He grips the black and gold handle and pulls out the sword. As he draws out the gleaming weapon, his robed assistant takes the sheath. Hattori raises the sword perpendicular to his body, then quickly turns it in his hands. Hattori lowers the sword and looks along the length of its gently curving blade. He holds it straight out in front of him, then rests the side of the blade against his robed arm. He draws the back of the blade across his sleeve, then closes his eyes and sighs deeply. I have completed doing what I swore an oath to God 28 years ago to never do again. I have created something that kills people. And in that purpose, I was a success. I have done this because philosophically, I am sympathetic to your aim. I can tell you with no ego, this is my finest sword. If on your journey you should encounter God, God will be cut. He offers the sword to the bride, who is kneeling in front of him dressed in a similar flowing white kimono. She takes it reverentially, and he urges, "Yellow-haired warrior, go." Her fingers curl around the sheath, and she bows her head. Chapter 5. Showdown at the House of Blue Leaves.
It was 1 year after the massacre in El Paso, Texas, that Bill backed his Nippon progeny financially and philosophically in her Shakespearean and magnitude power struggle with the other Yakuza clans over who would rule vice in the city of Tokyo. When the final sword was sheathed, it was Oren Ishii and her powerful posse, the Crazy 88, that proved the victor. The pretty lady to Oren's right, who's dressed like she's a villain on Star Trek, is Oren's lawyer, best friend, and second lieutenant. The half-French, half-Japanese Sophie Fatale. Another former protege of Bill's.
A dining room.
The young girl in the schoolgirl uniform is Oren's personal bodyguard, 17-year-old Gogo Yubari. Gogo may be young, but what she lacks in age, she makes up for in madness.
A man in a bar asks Gogo, "Do you like Ferrari?" She blurts, "Ferrari, Italian trash." She puts down the large wine bottle she was swigging, turns to the man and asks, "Do you want to screw me?" "Don't laugh. Do you want to screw me, yes or no?" "Yes." She stabs him somewhere down below. "How about now, big boy? Do you still wish to penetrate me? Or is it I who has penetrated you?" His guts spew out.
See what I mean? The bald guy in the black suit and the Kato mask is Johnny Mo, the head general of Oren's personal army, the Crazy 88. And just in case you're wondering, how could a half-breed Japanese-Chinese-American become the boss of all bosses in Tokyo, Japan? I'll tell you. The subject of Oren's blood and nationality came up before the council only once, the night Oren assumed power over the crime council. The man who seems bound and determined to break the mood is Boss Tanaka. And what Boss Tanaka thinks is...
He slams his fist into his dish. Another boss asks, "Boss Tanaka, what is the meaning of this outburst? This is a time for celebration." He replies, "And what exactly are we celebrating? The perversion of our illustrious council?" "Tanaka, have you gone mad? I will not tolerate this. You're disrespecting our sister. Apologize." Oren interjects, "Tanaka-san, of what perversion do you speak?" Sitting at the end of the table, Tanaka looks thoughtful. To the other bosses, he says, "My father, along with yours and along with yours, started this council. And while you laugh like stupid donkeys, they weep in the afterlife. Shut up! Over the perversion committed today." Another boss erupts. "Outrageous! Tanaka, it is you who insult the council, bastard!" To which Tanaka counters with, "Fuckface." "Gentlemen," Oren commands silence. Tanaka obviously has something on his mind. By all means, allow him to express it. Tanaka continues, I speak of the perversion done to this council, which I love more than my own children. By making a Chinese, Jap-American, half-breed bitch its leader. Oren runs down the table and slices off Tanaka's head. It falls onto the table and a geyser of blood jets out of his neck. Gogo and Sophie smile. Oren holds her sword aloft and says, "So that you understand how serious I am, I'm going to say this in English." She flicks her sword and blood spatters into one of the other boss's faces. Then she sheathes her blade.
As your leader, I encourage you from time to time, and always in a respectful manner, to question my logic. If you're unconvinced a particular plan of action I've decided is the wisest, tell me so. But allow me to convince you, and I promise you right here and now, no subject will ever be taboo. Except, of course, the subject that was just under discussion. The price you pay for bringing up either my Chinese or American heritage as a negative is, I collect your fucking head. Just like this fucker here. Now, if any of you sons of bitches got anything else to say, now's the fucking time! I didn't think so.
She then says, "Gentlemen, this meeting is adjourned."
One ticket to Tokyo, please.
A plane icon traverses the globe towards Tokyo. A jumbo jet soars across a blood-red sky. The bride sits looking out of the window, her sword resting against the cabin wall. A sleek black car cruises across a bridge, escorted by six black-clad motorcyclists who weave in and out of its path. Oren sits in the back seat of the black car, staring ahead with an expression of placid calm. Gogo's driving, tapping her finger on the steering wheel as the Tokyo skyline slides past. The plane cruises over the city. The bride looks out of the window at the light-speckled cityscape below. Oren and her escorts roar through a tunnel. All of the motorcyclists have swords protruding from the back of their vehicles. The bride curls her fingers around the handle of her sword as she looks down at the city streets, closer now. She strides through the airport, the sword in her hand. Now she's roaring along the road on a high-powered yellow motorbike and dressed in a yellow leather jumpsuit with a thick black stripe down the arms and legs. She's also wearing a yellow helmet with a jet black visor. She rides up alongside Sophie's car. Sophie stares through the windshield, oblivious to the deadly presence on her right. Her toenails painted red, Sophie presses down on the accelerator and she speeds ahead. A traffic light turns red, and Sophie and the bride come to a stop side by side. The bride's yellow helmet is drenched in blood-red light as she turns to look at Sophie, who's chatting on the phone. In the church, she remembers Sophie answering her mobile phone.
もしもし? はい、ご注意ですか。また後でもう一回かけていただけますでしょうか。奥様もご一緒ですか。はい、わかりました。はい。
The bride looks back at the road and roars through the red light. Oren and her posse stride down a plush corridor, Oren's sandaled feet treading gently on the stone floor. In slow motion, the band ease down the corridor, Oren at the front wearing a white kimono, and Gogo and Sophie behind her dressed in black. Members of the black eye mask wearing Crazy 88s follow on behind, holding their swords. They emerge into a spacious restaurant area, where they're greeted with ingratiating bows by the restaurant's owner and his wife. They lead them past the dance floor and up a wooden staircase. A band of girls, the 5678s in tight yellow outfits, are playing on a stage. O'Ren and her entourage are led along a first-floor walkway overlooking the main area. Then the restaurant owners pull back a sliding door set into a wall, revealing a spacious room beyond. Beneath the walkway, the 5678s are rocking. The restaurant owner and his wife come down the stairs, talking excitedly with each other. The bride's sitting at the bar in her yellow jumpsuit, her helmet beside her. She looks up towards the stairs. O'Ren and Sophie smile as one of the 88s tells a graphic story. The bride's crouching outside the room. O'Ren senses something and throws a dart through the translucent paper walls. Gogo dashes outside and draws a dagger from a sheath. She looks up and down the walkway, then across the bustling dance floor and along the walkway stretching round the room. Little does Gogo realise that the bride is right above her, clinging to the high ceiling, spread-eagled with her hands and feet finding purchase on the wooden beams. She looks down on the teenage warrior, straining to keep herself in place. Gogo's eyes look left and right, then she sheathes her dagger. The bride watches as Gogo plucks the dart from a wooden beam. Oblivious, the barefooted band dance on stage as Gogo returns to the room. She slides the door closed and the bride drops down from the ceiling. The bride comes downstairs. She walks along a corridor. She enters a bathroom where a woman is standing at the sink brushing her hair. The bride glances round warily, then heads into a cubicle. A light comes on inside, making the cubicle's finely woven divide semi-transparent. The bride removes her biker gear to reveal a similarly coloured tracksuit underneath. Out in the corridor, the restaurant owner's wife urges him, "You have to say yes, yes, yes to any selfish demands they make." He replies, "They demand ridiculous things," to which she snaps, "Shut up! Do you know what would happen if they heard you? Did you hear about the Tanaka clan? You're going to get your head chopped off!" He blurts, "No, I don't want that." As the owner and his wife take drinks into Oren's room, Sophie emerges and walks down a flight of stairs. She crosses the crowded dance floor, where enthusiastic patrons are jiving to the live music. She passes through the throng of people on her way to the bathrooms, dressed in a severe charcoal kimono, and her dark brown hair is pulled back in a tight bun. The bride zips up her Bruce Lee-style tracksuit. The all-too-familiar ringtone makes her eavesdrop on Sophie's call. "Yes, it's me, and if you give us a contact number, we will get back to you." From inside the cubicle, the bride glares at Sophie. A crazy 88 teases the restaurant owner. Who do you remind me of? Ah, Charlie Brown. The owner's wife chuckles. You're right, he does look like Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown, four pepperoni pizzas. The owner replies, that's not on our menu. I don't care, bring them, goddammit. A female 88 asks Charlie for a kiss. Orenishi, you and I have unfinished business. A door to Oren's room slides open, crazy 88 spill out. Down below, the other patrons are standing stock still. As Oren appears, the bride steps out from behind a fearful-looking Sophie, whose lips bleeding and her left arms resting on a wooden support beam. Meeting the bride's volatile gaze for the first time, Oren whispers something in recognition. Oren's stoic face looking down on her flashes across the bride's glare as she remembers her ill-fated wedding day. Suddenly, the bride hacks off Sophie's arm. Oren lets out a gasp, and the 88s draw their swords as Sophie writhes on the floor, spewing blood from her stump. Oren meets the bride's steely gaze and watches calmly as the other patrons flee. The bride, battered with Sophie's blood, now approaches across the dance floor. Unlike Oren, her crazy 88 entourage are tense. But the bride pauses by a bridge over an indoor water feature. Neither warrior breaks eye contact with the other, and the bride raises an eyebrow expectantly. Over Sophie's painful cries, Oren utters an order. Charlie Brown beat it, and he scampers away. Oren sends in an 88. Mickey. He somersaults down onto the bridge and advances on the bride, who slices through his sword blade, skewers him on hers, raises him off the ground on it, and then dumps him into the water. Oren cries out, "Tear the bitch apart!" And the elite 88s storm down the stairs. The bride stands ready, and despite three of them surrounding her, she dispatches them with ease. Her final vertical strike down one of Oren's bodyguards sends her Hanzo blade into a resonating vibration. She snaps her fist down on the hilt to stop it dead, before pointing her sword at two more suited 88s walking down the stairs towards her. With a flurry of parries, she deflects their initial attacks. They stand back for a moment, raising their blades above their heads before suddenly attacking. She slashes one across the chest, sending him falling back into the pool, before turning her attentions to the second crazy 88, a female warrior. They prowl across the room, their eyes locked on one another, and their swords raised. The crazy 88 leaps forward, but the bride deflects her strike and skewers her through the chest. The 88 raises her sword. The bride flicks the blood off her blade, then stares up at Oren, who has been watching the massacre with an impassive expression.
So, Oren, any more subordinates for me to kill?
Hi.
The bride says, go-go, right? To the young girl in the school uniform who's wielding a meteor hammer, two large metal balls connected by a thick chain. Go-go replies, and you're the Black Mamba. The bride responds, our reputations precede us.
Go-go, I know you feel you must protect your mistress, but I beg you, walk away.
Go-Go smiles innocently and says, you call that begging? Suddenly, her expression changes into a venomous stare and she taunts, you can beg better than that. The bride looks at the weighty chunk of metal on the end of Go-Go's chain with a faint smile. then raises her Hanzo blade. Gogo begins twirling her weapon above her head like a lasso. Gogo edges forward, and the bride starts edging back across the room. Gogo flicks the ball on the end of the chain forward. The bride deflects it away from her sword, sending the ball crashing into one of the wooden pillars that line the room. The schoolgirl then responds with a volley of strikes, one of which hits the bride square in the chest. The chain becomes tangled up around the sword, and Gogo yanks the bride's weapon away from her. Another blow to the chest sends the unarmed bride crashing into a table. Gogo smiles sadistically. The bride flips back onto her feet and then uses a table as cover. The meteor smashes through it, tearing it to pieces. Now wielding one of the table legs, the bride backflips spectacularly across the room and Gogo rushes towards her. Now they're both standing on tabletops. Gogo hurls the meteor towards the bride's feet, but she leaps out of the way at the last moment and lands gracefully on another tabletop. Gogo flings the meteor forward once more, but the bride uses the table leg like a bat and smacks the ball back towards her. It ricochets off a pillar and cracks Gogo on the back of the head. Gogo gets back to her feet and presses a concealed button which reveals a hidden blade in the metal ball. She hurls it at the bride and the meteor blade cuts into her arm. A second attack misses, but the chain gets twisted around the bride's neck and Gogo steps forward, tightening its grip. Chain links dig into the bride's neck, choking the life out of her. She falls to her knees, but then spots a table leg with nails protruding from it. She grabs it and swipes it down onto Gogo's foot, wrenches it out and strikes again. Suddenly, the chain falls loosely to the floor. Gogo slumps to her knees, blood dripping from her eyes. She keels over with the table leg stuck in the side of her head. The bride pulls the chain off her neck, then walks across the room to retrieve her Hanzo blade from the floor. Oren picks up her short sword and slowly pulls it out of its scabbard. She stabs it into the dark wooden railing in front of her as the bride starts to look around anxiously. She closes her eyes for a moment, then looks back up at Oren, who is now staring back at her with a self-satisfied smile.
Is that what I think it is?
You didn't think it was going to be that easy, did you?
You know, for a second there? Yeah, I kind of did.
Silly rabbit. Tricks are for kids.
The full complement of Crazy 88 comes racing into the restaurant, from every door and passageway. The masked warriors leap downstairs and over railings towards the bride. They form a tight circle around her, offering no room for escape. The bride stands motionless, except for her eyes, which slowly scan the group. The Crazy 88 edge forward, their circle tightening around the bride. She lifts her katana, and the 88 step back. Using the blade's perfect finish to check her rear guard, she prepares for the first attack. Another circle of Crazy 88s form, and the inner one gets ready to strike, but it's the bride who moves first, slashing with maniacal skill. The Hanzo blade cuts through Oren's warriors, sending their blood squirting into the air. As another charges towards her, she plucks out his eye. With the action now taking place in black and white, the bride's kicked back into the center of the circle. She swipes upwards, hacking off the arm of one of the masked men, and then embedding her blade into the stomach of another. One of the crazy 88 hurls a small axe at the bride. She catches the first, then dodges the second, which hurtles past only inches from her face and kills a foe behind her. She throws the axe she caught back to where it came from, hitting the 88 right between the eyes. Then she embarks upon a killing frenzy, dispatching foe after foe with her Hanzo blade. She knocks one 88's sword out of his hand, then decapitates him, sending blood gushing everywhere. Another masked warrior takes a swipe, but the bride leaps up onto his shoulders. Carefully balancing, she takes care of another 88, somersaults back to the floor and chops a man in half. Then Johnny Moe enters the fray. With a tremendous leap and using a sword stuck into a wall to give her a foot up, she grabs onto the upper balcony. The 88 race up the stairs to meet her. The first two are slashed immediately. Blood sputtering from his chest, a masked 88 topples over the balcony and plummets into a table below. Johnny Moe's back on the attack. The bride races along the landing and grabs onto a bamboo pole. Fixed into position, it bends and she gracefully swings down to the ground, dispatches a few 88s, then lets go of the pole, knocking Johnny Moe unconscious. Cartwheeling across the room, she slaughters several more 88s, then spots O'Ren disappearing into a side room and ups the tempo. Dashing through the restaurant and hurling her sword in all directions, she takes care of several more of O'Ren's bodyguards, but their numbers seem endless. An attacker's blade gets stuck in a beam and she stabs him in the chest. Realizing that she's becoming surrounded, she starts spinning the foe around, still impaled on her blade. Maneuvering herself and the skewered 88 into the center of the room, she slowly looks around at her opponents. Suddenly, she kicks the kebabbed foe away and snatches his sword. She begins twirling around furiously, almost breakdancing on the floor. Her blades whirl at impossible speeds, severing hands, legs, and feet all around her in a gruesome bloodbath. Getting back to her feet, she races back to the stairs, running up the banister with incredible agility and leaping to avoid a sword swipe at the top. The remaining few crazy 88s follow her, but seem a little more cautious than before. She lures them into a side room, and instead of using a doorway, one of the 88s cuts through the rice paper wall. She blinks, and the action returns to colour. The restaurant owner's wife shuts the lights off, and the room is bathed in an eerie, almost neon blue light. Their figures cast in silhouette, the remaining 88 strike as one. Wheeling like a whirling dervish, the bride's Hanzo blade takes out her enemies one by one. The last few 88s attack, but the bride dodges them with tremendous athleticism. She chops off one of their hands, then slashes another across the chest. Now, only one fighter remains, and he's shaking with fear. He backs away, anxiously, barely able to keep his sword steady. The lights come on, and she sees his young, terrified face. With a series of huge swipes, she chops lengths off his sword. Left with a tiny stub of a blade, he throws his hands up in surrender. She bends him over her knee and spanks his bottom with her sword.
This is what you get for fucking around, Yakuzas! Go home to your mother!
The young 88 runs off, wiping his eyes and clutching his behind. Suddenly, Johnny Moe appears behind the bride. He kicks her in the sternum, sending her halfway down the staircase. She rides herself and the two fight it out whilst balancing on the banisters. The bride regains her balance and holds the blade above her head. The bald-headed leader of the 88 spins towards her, brandishing two long-bladed knives. The bride deflects his blows whilst edging back along the tiny wooden platform. Then she ducks one of his attacks and slices off his leg, sending him plunging into a bloody pool below. After a deep breath, she flicks the blood off her sword, then looks down at the scene of absolute crimson slaughter below. She exclaims, "Those of you lucky enough to still have your lives, take them with you." However, leave the limbs you've lost. They belong to me now.
Except you, Sophie. You stay right where you are.
The smartly dressed restaurant owner's wife tries to make her way through the massacre, but slips on the blood that's splattered all over the floor. Meanwhile, the bride steps away and heads into the side room Oren was in. She looks over at the paper door on the far side and pulls it open to reveal a beautiful, snow-covered Japanese garden. She walks slowly along a rocky path towards a small pond. Oren, standing on the far side of the serene garden, is watching her closely.
Your instrument is quite impressive.
She adds, "Where was it made?"
Okinawa.
Okinawa no Daragasa.
Whom in Okinawa made you this steel?
This is Hattori Hanzo's steel.
Usotsuke.
You lie. The bride flicks over the blade to show Hanzo's dragon mark upon it. Oren smiles and says, "Swords, however, never get tired. I hope you've saved your energy." If you haven't, you might not last 5 minutes. But as last looks go, you could do worse. She slips off her right clog-like sandal and carefully pushes it behind her with her foot. As the blood-splattered bride stares at her intensely, she carefully does the same with the other shoe, making faint imprints in the sparkling snow. Oren steps towards the bride and bows down gracefully, then slowly reaches behind her and pulls out her own sword. She holds it up in front of her in a horizontal position, then with an almost ritualistic slowness, removes it from its sheath. The bride lifts the Hanzo blade up to her face, pointing the tip straight at Oren. Oren slowly brings both hands back down to her side, and then the bride launches an attack. With her sword in one hand and the scabbard in the other, Oren uses both instruments as weapons. She lunges forward and they exchange blows. Having separated, Oren looks down at her scabbard to see that the bride has sliced the end off. Staring intently at her opponent, she discards the scabbard. Now grasping her blade in both hands, Oren slowly raises it. The bride edges forward, also bringing her free hand onto the hilt of her sword. Their blade tips touch, and after a moment's stillness, the bride tries to thrust Oren's blade away. bride tries to dodge a strike, but Oren's blade slashes across her back. Blood pours from the bride's wound as she collapses on the snow.
Silly Caucasian girl likes to play with samurai swords. You may not be able to fight like a samurai, but you can at least die like a samurai.
Oren rests her sword across her arm and points it at the bride. Badly wounded, the bride slowly manages to sit herself up. She plunges her sword into the snow to help her, then pulls it up vertically to her face. Staring ruthlessly at Oren, she says, "Attack me with everything that you have." Oren smashes her blade down, but the bride blocks the strike. The bride counterattacks, and Oren backs away a little, stumbling. A small feature in the pond continually fills and empties water. A deep crimson trickle runs down Oren's leg and through her once pristine kimono. The two fierce fighters stare intensely at one another as they try to catch their breath. Snow falls silently around them. Oren whispers, "For ridiculing you earlier, I apologize." The bride stares back at her and, close to tears, says, "Accepted."
Wakatta.
The pond feature fills with water once more. "Ready?" the bride asks. Oren responds, "Come on." The two women charge towards each other and fight. Oren retreats behind a fence and the bride chases after her. She spins round and strikes a lightning blow, sending a streak of Oren's blood into the snow. Oren's scalp, with her long dark hair still attached to it, falls into the white powder. Her sword slips from her grasp, and she says, "That really was a Hattori Hanzo sword."
Hattori Hanzo.
With the top of her brain now exposed, Oren stands motionless, whilst the bride remains in the position of her final strike. With the snow falling gently all around, Oren falls to her knees, and after a moment, slumps to her side. The bride starts to turn her head to look at Oren's body, but then changes her mind and hobbles away. With the shadows of the garden's perfectly kept trees cast across the snow, the bride reaches a small wooden bench and sits down. She hunches over and lets the Hanzo blade fall from her hand. Sometime later, she crosses through Oren's name at the top of the death list. Now, wearing her yellow biker leathers, she shuts Sophie in a car boot. Later, stopping the car at the side of the road, she opens the boot. She pulls Sophie out and tosses her down a snow-covered embankment at the side of the road. Sophie tumbles roughly down the slope, finishing in the middle of another road outside a hospital. Two paramedics immediately run over and call for help. Later, Bill's with Sophie, who's in a wheelchair.
Sophie. Sophie. My Sophie. I'm so sorry.
Please, please forgive my betrayal.
No more of that.
But still...
Nothing. Except my aching heart at what she's done to my beautiful and brilliant Sophie.
I've kept you alive for two reasons. First reason is information.
Sophie spits back in French. Burn in hell, you stupid, stupid blonde. I'll tell you nothing.
But I am gonna ask you questions. And every time you don't give me answers, I'm gonna cut something off. And I promise you, they will be things you will miss. Give me your other arm! I want all the information on the deadly vipers.
If you had to guess...
What they've been doing?
Why she left you alive.
And where I can find them.
What would be your guess?
Guessing won't be necessary. She informed me. She said I could keep my wicked life for two reasons. As I said before, I've allowed you to keep your wicked life for two reasons. And the second reason is so you can tell him in person everything that happened here tonight. I want him to witness the extent of my mercy by witnessing your deformed body. I want you to tell him all the information you just told me. I want him to know what I know. I want him to know. And I want them all to know. They'll all soon be as dead as a rat.
On a plane, the bride writes Death List 5 across the top of a sheet of paper. She scores a line underneath the title. In her mind, she thinks about Hattori Hanzo's words. Revenge is never a straight line. It's a forest. And like a forest, it's easy to lose your way, to get lost, to forget where you came in. Now, Bud speaks.
That woman deserves her revenge. He deserved to die.
She must suffer to her last breath.
Having written Elle's name as fourth on the list, the bride adds the fifth and final entry, Bill. In flashback to her wedding day.
How did you find me?
I'm the man. One more thing, Sophie. Is she aware her daughter is still alive?